Our program tonight, another in my summer series commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Hambone Kelly's Nightclub, owned by the Lou Waters Yerba Buena Jazz Band, will be divided into three sections. The first and third being musical, the middle, an interview with the band's second trumpeter, Bob Scobie. The full powerhouse band of 1946 opens the show with typical renditions featuring the strong brass section and emphasizing, especially on the second, the two trumpet team of Waters and Scobie. Sage Hen Strut and That's a Plenty.
Thank you.
Sage Hen Strut, recorded at the Dawn Club in the fall of 1946, and That's a Plenty in the April recording sessions for the now defunct jazz label called West Coast, which is now available and from which we heard it on a Good Time Jazz revamped LP, where the sound is a good deal better than the original. That's a Plenty, featuring, I think, especially the excellent two-trumpet work of that Waters band, the full eight, occasionally nine-piece powerhouse band that many of us think of as the Lou Waters Yerba Buena jazz band. And we have with us this evening Bob Scobie, well-known in his own right as trumpeter extraordinary, band leader, and certainly a gentleman who has kept his faith in jazz and in his own form of jazz these many years since the Lou Waters band, in which he played for a long time. It's nice to have you with us, Bob, and in this few minutes that I would like to cover in a multitude of subjects, first we ought to just ask you, how's it sound to hear especially some of the Dawn Club Fall of 46 broadcast stuff?
Well, Phil, it's frankly rather interesting. As a matter of fact, I haven't heard these sides for a number of years. I have this album, and I just never have gotten around to listening to it lately. It's been since it's been reissued. On
certainly, the sound is considerably better than the old.
It certainly is.
Tinny surfaces, and I've always thought it was very. It was a tragedy that you fellas did all of those recordings by the big band all in such a short period of time and under such poor recording circumstances.
Well, you know, Phil, these were the days when, before tape, and you had to get a good take on the record on the first crack, or at least on one complete take. You couldn't fill in as you can now on tape. It makes it much easier.
But, of course, those were done about 3 months after the reorganized post-war Waters band. Going way back to the early days, when did you first encounter those gentlemen who were to become your sidekicks and colleagues in the Waters band?
Well, as my memory serves me, I believe it was sometime around 1939 that I first became associated with Lou in a large group that he had playing at Sweet's Ballroom in Oakland, about a 13-piece band. And it was after that band that he organized the Dixie Group, a smaller group, which I was not with at first. He rehearsed for some time before actually taking an engagement, and I think I did play on the first engagement that he ever had with this.
You were playing
group.
The second trumpet. Were you familiar with the Oliver Band recordings at all when you...
Not too well. At the time, I had been playing, I believe, at the Geary Theater. It was a show called Meet the People. You might remember that. It was sort of a politically conscious show. It was a very excellent show, too. People really enjoyed it, and I did. But I didn't want to digress here. I just... my background prior to going with Waters was mostly playing in theaters and nightclubs and ballrooms and even playing taxi dance in Oakland.
Well, that's a straight field for almost everyone at any time in jazz. Did you, when you picked up with the Waters band and they had a bit of a book, was this something that bothered you ever?
Well, no. You see, I had quite a bit of experience in reading music. I studied classical music for a while, and so since everything was arranged, there wasn't much of a problem there. It's difficult to just improvise when you have that many instruments, almost impossible.
When do you recall the break came on improvisation as contrasted to the straight reading of the Waters band?
Well, actually, unless I'm mistaken, I don't believe that we ever improvised in that band. We simply learned the tunes and memorized them, and then played them. Of course, I don't say that we played them note for note each time. There was quite a bit of freedom allowed there, but basically we had a part to follow, and of course a harmony line that we had to stick to, otherwise it would have been confusion.
On the old Water, the old Oliver recordings, there have been times when the pundits have been able to discover that Louis Armstrong left his second part and actually played lead, and it was Oliver playing the second. Did you and Lou used to swap off the lead?
Yes, we interchanged that way all the time.
Just never consistent, so that one can say, well, on this tune it was always Lou leading or always Bob leading.
Very seldom that he played the lead all the way through on a tune, or that I did. Mm-hmm. It was mostly back and forth. The volume we were playing, it was difficult to last throughout an entire number.
Do you think that there were shortcomings in that Big Water
show, too? People really enjoyed it, and I did. But I don't want to digress here. I just, my background prior to going with Waters was mostly playing in theaters and nightclubs and ballrooms and even playing taxi dance in Oakland.
Well, that's a straight field for almost everyone at any time in jazz. Did you, when you picked up with the Waters band and they had a bit of a book, you were just dropped into the second horn part. Was this something that bothered you ever?
Well, no. You see, I had quite a bit of experience in reading music. I studied classical music for a while, and so since everything was arranged, there wasn't much of a problem there. It was difficult to just improvise when you have that many instruments. It's almost impossible.
Do you recall that the break came on improvisation as contrasted to the straight reading of the Waters band?
Well, actually, unless I'm mistaken, I don't believe that we ever improvised in that band. We simply learned the tunes and memorized them. Mm-hmm. And then played them. Of course, I don't say that we played them note for note each time. There was quite a bit of freedom allowed there, but basically we had a part to follow, and of course a harmony line that we had to stick to, otherwise it would have been confusion.
On the old Water, the old Oliver recordings, there have been times when the pundits have been able to discover that Louis Armstrong left his second part and actually played lead, and it was Oliver playing the second. Did you and Lou used to swap off the lead?
Yes, we interchanged that way all the time.
Just never consistent, so that one can say, well, on this tune it was always Lou leading or always Bob leading.
Very seldom that he played the lead all the way through on a tune, or that I did. Mm-hmm. It was mostly back and forth. The volume we were playing, it was difficult to last throughout an entire number.
Do you think that there were shortcomings in that Big Waters band? I mean, obviously you left it at a time when you wanted to get off on your own, but say that it had been very successful financially and commercially, would you have been happy musically to have stayed in the big band?
Well, I'm sure I would have if the band had made progress. I think the band was improving up to the time it broke up, but there was certainly, I wouldn't say that it was without problems. I felt that there was a rhythm problem there that we, not necessarily related to the rhythm section itself, but I think due to the entire group, mm-hmm. probably in a matter of approaching the rhythm idea.
Do you think that... Well, you know that Lou had commented a few weeks ago on this program that the idea was that the rhythm just went along on its own and it was up to them to keep going regardless. Is this pretty... Don't you agree that was about the noisiest back row that...
It was pretty potent, I must say. I mean, we made lots of noise.
And with the tuba going full blast and banjo, it would have been difficult for any other member of the band to have done very much about the rhythm.
Yes, I think that the tuba probably set the beat more than any other instrument in the band because of the simplicity of the tuba.
Well, and of course, the way Dick Lammy played it particularly, one might say that he's a very persuasive individual on the horn when he starts playing.
There's a certain amount of visual thing there, too, that... Yeah, he used to rock back and forth.
Yes.
Excuse me. Incidentally, I think that in the recent years, people, former Lou Waters fans, come up and discuss the band with me, and I don't think that one out of 50 failed to mention Lammy, and they, of course, they don't remember his name, but they remember that tuba player who used to rock back and forth.
And strangely enough, Bob, I've had the same thing happen with people discussing it with me in a club, and now and then it has been at a place like the Tin Angel, for instance, where Lammy was literally playing the string bass there, and these people had no idea that it was the same individual, or maybe he was playing the banjo that threw them even further off. Possibly
right.
Turk would be wise at this time to put Lammy... seat Lammy
back
on the banjo,
rocking tuba.
Go on to a rocking banjo, perhaps. When you and the Waters band moved across the bay to Hamboone Kelly's, you were at that time just beginning to do a little recording on your own, weren't you? Your first Trilon recordings were when, about 48, weren't they?
I think I had been playing at the at Hamill & Kelly's for some time before we started, I think a year or so before I made any records. It was the first record I made under my own name was with Trilon, and I believe it was about two or three days before the record ban went into effect.
You remember December of 48, then,
no recording. And we did these sides in a great rush, and they certainly sounded like it, too.
Did that begin your interest in having a band of your own, or had you, I suppose it's logical that all musicians someday, especially men in lead instruments, want to get off on their own. Had you been toying with this idea for quite a while?
Well, yes, I guess perhaps I had. I didn't, nothing materialized on it for a while there after we made those recordings with Trilon.
I just wondered if your leaving had something to do then with the Waters band, that the Yerba Buena band sound was something which you were getting to feel was constricting your abilities, or if you had wanted to go off on your own anyway?
I guess it was a combination of things, really. I don't think that any one particular thing was the paramount factor in my leaving the group. I had an opportunity to take a band in it myself, and of course everyone's interested in bettering themselves, or they think so anyway. I don't know whether it resulted in that or not.
I think also, Bob, that uniquely, and many people I know very well, that very few people will recall this, because if they had, the place would have stayed a little longer. You were the last musical occupant of the building, which was one time known as Hamble and Kelly's.
We took the... along with some other people, took over the club, the Hamble and Kelly's, after Lou left, and I guess it was 3 or 4 months after he vacated the premises, and called it Alexander's, and we didn't have a liquor license. And we tried to run it on the basis of just a dance with soft drinks and beer and wine, I believe we did have, and it didn't work out too well. We didn't have very much money for advertising, for one thing, and then people somehow seemed to us feel the need for drinking when they're listening to Dixie.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but I think that they do want to go to a place that they feel is more conducive to that which they associate with older jazz, and especially with a lot of teenage kids around that are drinking Cokes and dancing modern style and everything, that it would deter from some of the old-timers. Lou commented, and I have said a number of times, and most of the Waters band has said, that a great deal of the fun were older people who came in and helped to pass the word. They didn't know who King Oliver was from Adam, but they remembered a kind of a beat and a style and a sound, and perhaps a club like Hambone's or the Dawn Club certainly had a speakeasy atmosphere about it.
That's right.
I would like to go on, Bob, but in the midst of all of this, it's been nice of you to go out of your way and try to recall some of the older days. I know it's been very quick as far as an interview is concerned. In your thinking back, do you believe that there's a chance for a band like the Waters band? I don't mean just New Orleans or Dixieland or whatever you want to call it. Do you think there's a chance that that sort of thing can come back in the full-blown imitative form?
Oh, yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, I believe there are two bands in existence today that I know of, and I'm sure there must be more, that sound... very much like the Lou Waters band, to the point of actually copying the arrangements and copying the style of the individuals. One of them, of course, is the local Bay City jazz band. I don't mean to say that they deliberately copied everything that Lou did. I know they do have some of Lou's arrangements, or I've heard they did. And there is also a group at Purdue University called the Salty Dogs. Uh-huh. And they're very much like the Lou Waters group. They didn't have the two trumpets, but they play most of the arrangements that we used, and they have a trombone player that sounds more like Turk Murphy than Turk Murphy.
Well, perhaps sometime after you're through with your current rush of activities, we can get back and let you do a little bit of narration and go through the some of your recordings yourself with us, Bob, on the Jazz Archives.
Well, thanks, Phil. It's so nice of you to give me the opportunity to be here.
Okay, and we're going to go right from the interview into two more recordings that feature the Hambone Kelly's Latter Day Yerba Buena Jazz Band, Sans Bob Scobie. Two tunes, one of which was never recorded by the Full Waters Band, Some of These Days, and then secondly, an old-timer, one of the first records that Louis Armstrong ever made under his own name and a standard in the Waters book called Come Back, Sweet Papa.
Thank you.
two recordings from the Hambone Kellys, late band led by Lou Waters, Some of These Days, and Come Back Sweet Papa. And I have very little else to say, especially since I'd like to include one more on-the-spot Hambone Kellys recording on tonight's program. This is from June of 1950, about 6 months before the demise of the whole operation. It features Lou and Don Kinch on trumpet and cornet, respectively, plus Turk Murphy on trombone and the rest of the small Yerba Buena band at Hambone Kellys, strutting with some barbecue. Last recordings with Lou Waters combined with Turk Murphy and a second trumpeter, Don Kinch in that case, strutting with some barbecue. It's my hope on these last few programs in the summer series to be able to present considerably more music from Hambone Kelly's by the Lou Waters Band without additional commentary on my part. Suffice to say, from 1948 until 1950, there were frequent personnel changes and considerably more sitting in by other jazzmen than had been the case in the earlier days. The results were irregular and, as often as not, quite superior and quite often disorganized. But the music was less distinctively Waters-sounding and thus often neglected by the original Yerba Buena Band fans. For this reason, I'm attempting in each broadcast to present comparative selections matching the so-called original big band in previously unreleased performances, whenever possible, against the smaller aggregations of future years.